Hello and welcome to the Eastman Financial Report. My name is Dan Eastman, your host, and today is Wednesday, September 20th, 2023. I'd like to thank you for tuning in. I think I'm going to change the name to the Eastman Financial Doom and Gloom Report one of these days. Lots of news and none of it's good with respect to the economy, but thank you for tuning in. Thank you also for watching. Seriously, thank you for watching WVW TV. We're always honored to have you as viewers on our programming and our network. And we do truly try to bring you cutting edge information that is from an alternative point of view that you're probably not going to see in the mainstream media, except I'm noticing more and more with my show that when I present materials, then I see the same materials the next day or two in the mainstream media. So it's nice for me to know that I'm being effective in communicating these issues. So when you're watching this program, we may be a smaller program on a somewhat less or more obscure network, but you are certainly hearing cutting edge financial news. And it's always flattering for me to see that the things I talk about are being echoed elsewhere in the financial press. And that's great, because what we want to do is reach consensus on the economic situation we have. I'd like to remind you that we are a sponsored network. We rely on the generosity of viewers like you to make donations to keep us going. And we also have sponsors who also help keep the lights on. And we're thankful for our sponsors. As you know by now, Swiss America Trading is my sponsor of my show. And they are a fine purveyor of precious metals, American-based company based in Arizona. Been in the precious metals space for a very long time. They know what they're doing. They're very high reputation. It's a great company to do business with. And if you're thinking about expanding your individual portfolio to include precious metals, I suggest you give them a call at 1-800-519-6271. Ask them for some free information about how you go about investing in tangible metals. And you can go to their website at SwissAmerica.com, and if you use the promo code EASTMAN, which stands for Eastman Financial Report, you will be able to get free information as well. So I wanted to mention one offer that they're running right now, which I think is a really amazing offer. And of course, this is adding a silver lining to this, all of these dark storm clouds that we're hearing every day. But they are right now offering, these are silver walking Liberty half dollar bullion coins, they're silver coins. And Swiss America is offering them at $13.50 a piece, and that includes shipping to you. So it's a really fantastic deal, because it's all in $13.50 per coin, and there's a limit of 250 per person, and only until supplies run out, because it's not an infinite offer. But if you are considering the addition of tangible precious metals to your portfolio, this is a great time to give Swiss America a call at 1-800-519-6271 and tell them Dan Eastman sent you, or if go online, use the promo code Eastman, and you will probably want to take a very close look at this offer, because you know, the precious metal markets, they go up and they go down, but this is a really great price if you're thinking about taking a position in physical silver. That's a really good price, so you want to reach out to them and give them a call. So, okay, I want to talk about lots of news today. Of course, we are on Wednesday, and the Federal Open Market Committee, the Federal Reserve's Policy Committee, is making its second day of decisions. They're having a great big discussion about what they should do with respect to monetary policy to impact the American economy. And it's my understanding that they will come out and make a pronouncement at 2 p.m. Eastern, which is 1 p.m. Central, which is about an hour and a half from now. And Jerome Powell of the Federal Reserve will come forth, and he will announce whether interest rates are going up, going down, staying the same, and give some rationale and reasoning behind it. And of course, all the smart money is gambling on the fact that they'll hold rates steady instead of raising them. But there's also some rumblings about town, at least on the media, that suggest that perhaps they're going to look at a November increase, because there's still a lot of inflationary pressure in the news. Now, the question is, what we've been doing the last couple of weeks is analyzing the news, peeling back the headline and seeing, you know, what exactly are we hearing? And of course, the smart people at the Federal Reserve are probably doing the same thing. I don't think they'll be schnookered by a headline or two. But the reality is, you want to be thinking about what is going on in the economy, and we will find out where the Federal Reserve is this month. It's in September, and we'll see what happens in the November timeframe and year end, whether they're going to raise rates or they're going to cut rates, which nobody's really predicting right now. But we'll see. And I think there's a lot of political pressure that's starting to build. And keep in mind, like I was saying yesterday, this political pressure is only going to get worse as we enter into 2024 with the big presidential election every 4 years. And of course, the incumbent will want to paint the picture of, you know, nothing but wine and roses. And the challenger will want to paint the doom and gloom that suggests a change. So be prepared and be aware. And that's why when you're thinking about what do you do as an individual investor or an individual citizen, maybe you don't even think of yourself as an investor. I mean, you're just trying to preserve your assets and figure out how to navigate the storm in the safest path. That's why you want to be thinking about alternative investments, and tangibles make a lot of sense, not only gold and silver, but also real estate and anything else that has value in a broader global marketplace that is somewhat detached from the federal dollar, because that's really what inflation is all about, more dollars to buy the same number of goods. Well, let's talk about some of the stories today. And there's one story that caught my eye right off the top. The story is pressure to find rental houses is pushing up prices. And what happened since 2008, when the housing market went through a major readjustment based on the collapse of Lehman Brothers and all these syndicated mortgage instruments that created such ripples through the debt markets that Lehman Brothers and some of these big firms, you know, Lehman collapsed, and it was a mess. It was a total mess. Well, as a result of that chaos, large institutional money, and let's break that down. The large institutional money, this means private equity money that, or perhaps even publicly traded money, that is aggregated into a pool to go shopping, okay? And they go shopping for houses. And what was unheard of prior to 2008 is a big institutional pool of money, billions and billions of dollars, shopping for a single family home somewhere because of the maintenance costs and the logistical nightmare of managing a portfolio of 50,000 single family homes scattered around America was a big challenge. Well, that's all come and gone. They've figured out how to basically syndicate the ownership of single family homes. And you're getting these very, very large pools of money owning 50,000, 100,000 homes throughout the country. And what they do is they've identified certain markets that are attractive where people want to live. And they have computers with algorithms. And every time a listing pops up on the multiple listing service or whatever online database is being used to list homes for sale, they run their computer algorithms, and they basically identify the best properties at the lowest price. And if there's any type of bidding competition with local folk, they just outbid them because they've got billions of dollars in the bank, and they can pay 10% more than everybody else. Because what is phenomenal is that the rent on a home, let's say you have a suburban home in a nice community, and if you want to, if you're an investor and you buy that home and rent it to somebody, the person renting it is still paying less overall than the cost of owning a home. Now, they're not factoring in inflation, okay? They're not factoring in appreciation. They're just looking at operating costs versus rent. And what has happened since 2008 is you have vast swaths of area that are owned by institutional investors that are renting these homes to people who rent. And there's nothing wrong with renting. It's just that when you are in the market for purchasing a home, and remember, I always say a rising tide floats all boats. And as we look at very serious inflation pressures, one way to have a boat in that rising tide is to own a home or a property. When you're renting, your rents keep going up and up and up with inflation, but you're not building any equity. So you own nothing, and you maybe think you're happy, and maybe you are happy, but what you're not is getting rich, and that's a big problem. So the story is that these big institutional homeowners are struggling to find supply because they have to keep feeding their pipeline. They raise more money, they buy more houses, they bring in more rent, they raise more money, they buy more houses. And the idea is, the trees don't grow out of the sky, but they get pretty close. this is what they're doing. And if you are, you know, a younger person or a millennial who's decided to climb out of the tower and buy a home, you are competing with Wall Street billionaires, man. You are competing with people who can outbid you in every last single auction. And more this is happening. Well, the complaints from these institutional buyers is there aren't enough houses to go out and buy. So now they're starting to build their own from scratch. You can imagine an entire subdivision of homes built to rent out to people. Nobody in the subdivision owns a house. They're all renters. Well, I don't know if that's good or bad, but it's not good if you're trying to buy a home and you're constantly competing against institutional money that's, you know, $2 billion in a fund. And that's a big problem because it's putting upward pressure on single family homes, and it's making it more and more unlikely that somebody who wants to buy a home can get into a home. And this is a big social justice issue as well. I mean, from an economic perspective, when you look at how, you know, the American dream was home ownership, and anybody who's owned a home over time knows that you sell it for more than you paid for it, unless you're in one of these bizarro cycles, like after 2008, all these housing prices collapsed for a little bit of time, you know? So everybody was selling and losing their shirt, or their home was underwater, they said, because they couldn't wait 2 years. And they, you know, there are people who lost money. But the reality is, if you hold and you've got an inflationary market, I mean, look at Phoenix. Phoenix is a boom and bust classic. It's an American classic, you know? But what happens is when prices bust, you know, and people get hurt, then suddenly 5 years later, I mean, it's as robust as ever. That's what you're looking at. So if you're trying to get into the housing market and you're competing against these institutional guys, it creates a real social problem. And one of the big arguments of the social justice crowd, and there's some merit to this, is that the way to become affluent in American society is to own a house. And if you can't get in for historical segregation reasons, or, you know, they say, well, their family doesn't have generational wealth, whatever it is, if you can't get on the elevator, then that elevator is leaving and you're standing there watching everybody go up and you're not going. And that does cause social disgruntlement because, you know, people want to be equally enabled economically. And I think economic, equality and justice is a big deal. And the only way to achieve that in a free market economy is that everybody has access to the same platform. And that's why I think that sometimes these are distortions within the private home ownership market. When you bring institutional investors in who play by completely different rules, and then they're not necessarily, you know, the guy manicuring the lawn every week, that becomes a real problem. And I think that's a problem that the politicians are going to have to look at. But from an economic perspective, as you're trying to shelter yourself from the coming inflationary nightmare, you know, the sooner you can get on that elevator, the better. And unfortunately, you know, the story is you're competing with housing guys, and they'll say, hey, we have every right to buy houses and rent them out. And they do. I mean, you can buy a house and rent it out, just that they can buy 100,000 houses and rent them out, and they can bid up the price until they get them, because, you know, they can pay 10 to 15% over anybody else and basically get the house they want. And if you're trying to bid into that, I mean, it's like if you've ever lost an auction on eBay, you know what it feels like. You know, there's somebody out there who's going to bid more than you are, and they get it, and it wasn't worth that price to me, or I couldn't pay that price. But at the end of the day, it's not a good feeling. So, not that economics has anything to do with feelings, but there's a social aspect and a social cost to all of these policies. So it's just something to watch out for. And I think the biggest problem is with 7.8, the next story, of course, is mortgage rates are at the highest again, 7.82 average. And these are really high mortgage rates in this cycle. At that point, you're getting the more marginal income buyers are having to drop away, while the institutional guys, what do they care? Because the whole institutional thing, they basically are paying cash. Well, you're going out and, you know, doing the mortgage application dance. They've got $1 billion. They're writing checks. And of course, if you're a seller, you can take a cash offer from an institutional buyer, or you can, you know, as a contingent on financing, will it close? And it's all of that, you know, uncertainty versus, hey, I'll take the check from, you know, the big guy on Wall Street. So anyway, I don't mean to belabor this point, but I think it's an issue that is triggered more and more by the Federal Reserve's activities with respect to these inflation rates. And okay, so I want to move on to the next story. Why? Which one do we choose next year? There's so many problems. The next big story is the debt. The story is broke. I've been talking about $32 trillion and suspending the debt ceiling. Well, now other media outlets are reporting that the debt has now exceeded $33 trillion. So I will no longer be saying 32. I will be saying 33. And keep in mind that if I were to hand you a dollar bill every second, $1 trillion. How long would it take to hand you $1 trillion every second? One every second. One, two, three. It would take 56,800 and some years. It's a long time. It's a lot of money. And we have gone from 32 trillion to 33 trillion in 3 months. Okay, let that soak in for just a few minutes. In 3 months, the federal government spent $1 trillion they didn't have. They had to go borrow it. Who in the world's got an extra $1 trillion laying around? Well, the world. Who in the world? Get it? The world has an extra $1 trillion to lend to the United States. And, you know, there's some interesting strategy because, the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, is now projecting that by 2030, that sounds like a long way, well, 7 years from now, it'll be $50 trillion in debt. And there's a strategy, you know, in the nasty marketplace of the, you know, global and human history, of if you give people enough credit, they will bankrupt, and then you can pick up the pieces on pennies on the dollar. And you have to ask the question: who are these generous souls lending to the federal government of the United States? My sense is they're not looking at that as a return on investment as much as a political return. You know, you give these guys enough rope, they're going to go broke and we're going to pick up the pieces. You know, what if we had to sell California to the Chinese to pay the debt? You know, that's just an absurd idea, but I've seen this floating around in interesting media outlets. This is the kind of thing we're talking about, that they're spending. So I guess we're going to be changing to 33 from 32 because it's official. And that leaves me to the government shutdown story that we've been talking about. And of course, there's only 10 days left before the government shuts down. Now, the government was going to shut down in January and February. And, you know, remember that discussion. And then they suspended the debt ceiling instead of raised it. Well, now they're pushing up against the fiscal year end. And in order, because we don't have a budget, they never passed a budget bill. It was never signed by the president. We don't, you know, Wisconsin, somewhat parochially, in Wisconsin, we have a two-year or a biennial budget. Every 2 years, we pass a budget. It's a law. The Assembly and the Senate, they pass it. Goes to the governor's desk, and we have this real cutesy little line item veto. They call it the Vanna White veto, where you can cross out certain letters and make the budget say something that they didn't pass in the legislature. Well, this happens every 2 years, and Republicans got their heads handed to them this time. You know, they were clever by less than half. But the point is, that's the law, and then that's the spending, and that's the budget, and that's how much we spend, and that's it. And then at the end of the two-year cycle, of course, if you're the governor, you will want to demonstrate that you have a little bit of surplus. Put it in the rainy day fund. See, aren't I a prudent manager of the public fisc? You want to look good, and that's what the executive does. He takes the program money that was passed by the legislature. You spend it prudently and carefully, always with the idea we got to keep a little bit back because we want to add to the rainy day fund, then I'll get reelected because people think I'm a good manager. They are. You know, that's usually how it works. And, you know, very seldom, unless there's a national crisis, will you run a state off the rails. Now, you know, California and Illinois with their crazy pension systems, yeah, they're always going broke. But most states are pretty prudent in what they do. And, of course, all the states are living on this extra COVID money. We got like $6 billion in Wisconsin. You know, we didn't know if we should use sterling silver doorknobs or 24 karat gold doorknobs. You know, we don't know what to spend this money on. But at the end of the day, that all came out of this federal $33 trillion in debt. And unfortunately, with this latest debate now in Congress, they have to pass a continuing resolution to fund, to keep the lights on. Now, this is under the constraints of law, because the House of Representatives controls the purse strings of government. They have to have a budget continuing resolution that allows the government to spend at the same or different rate because there's no budget law. So they're basically passing these little bullet bills, defense and, whatever they spend money on, they have to pass these. And if you don't pass it, there's a technicality. The problem is in the next fiscal year that starts October 1st, there's no money allocated. So if they were to go ahead and just spend it anyway, they'd be breaking the law. The question is, something short of the Lone Ranger or Batman, who's going to come and enforce the law? But this is the kabuki we're watching right now. And of course, there's a lot of political negotiations back on, because one said we want to increase spending for Ukraine. The other one said, no, we want to cut that spending and we want to build more bridges. And there's all this horse trading going on. But what I can assure you is, at least, I think I can assure you that September 30th and then October 1st, the government will not be shut down. And if it does shut down, it's only temporary, because there's always a way to come up with negotiations to get to where they need to be. And it's a lot of horse trading right now. But at the end of the day, other than I think this happened with the air traffic controllers once, went 2 weeks without a paycheck, but they always seem to come to conclusion. The problem that they're looking at is you're at $33 trillion in debt. So whatever they're doing, they don't have anywhere near the tax revenues to pay for any of this stuff. So it's all debt. We're going to borrow money for this, we're going to borrow money for that. And of course, we saw that $1 trillion in excess debt hit the American balance sheet in 3 months. 3 months. So, I mean, we're in a crazy season right now. And that's why, when you think about it, what do you do as a citizen, a taxpayer? You're the American people, the people. Well, we are the people. And then how do you protect yourself from this type of government irresponsibility? What do I do as an individual? Well, that's where this housing thing becomes a real thing. If you're sitting there with real estate, you can defend title and you have, right to own property, I'm assuming the American Constitution, the state constitutions will hold, then effectively, you're going to have some benefit as inflation just continues to hum along because of this massive debt load. And that's why, tangible assets are an important thing too. Like, you get Swiss America offering silver half dollars at $13.50. Get your calculator out, do the math, and that it might make sense to diversify into tangible assets. I think that's something you really need to be thinking about right now, because ultimately there's a consequence. You just simply can't believe that you spend $33 trillion plus, and they can't even get to the end of the fiscal year without funding the next fiscal year, and believe that system and not have some concerns that what happens if the wheels come off. And you want to be thinking about that. And I think that's where you have to step up and take care of your own, personal financial well-being. And that probably is going to be something more than, sticking your money in a stock market or something. Well, you might want to be thinking about a little bit broader strategy. How do you protect your buying power, your assets, if and when, you're going to see an acceleration in inflation. And keep in mind, as inflation continues to accelerate because of these natural push, we've got another story here, very interesting story. The United Auto Workers strike may spread to the parts suppliers. I talked about that yesterday, and then I read about it in the paper today. It was great. So I'm right. And the point is, this is having a widening impact. Then Stellantis, who's really Chrysler, Fiat, they are thinking that perhaps there may be plant closures, because when you get to the UAW settlement, there's going to be an increased labor cost, and you have to look at that in your operations. Remember, revenue minus expenses is income, and expenses are going up. That's your labor costs, okay? So that means your income starts to drop, and your return on equity, return on investment is declining. Then you make decisions. I'm going to close this plant. It's not profitable at that rate. That all is inflationary. And the same thing with oil. I was noticing that West Texas Intermediate oil is at $90 a barrel. But keep in mind with oil that it's a global market. Back in the good old days, 100 years ago, the United States was preeminent in automobile usage, application, manufacturing, highways. We got the best highways, we got the best cars, we got everything's good. But we were the only real market for automotive transportation. Now, the British had cars, but you know, that's a little island, okay? And the Germans had cars, and that, but Europe is kind of a little place. The Italians have great cars, and, you know, that's a little place too. Even the French had cars. Maybe they still do. Peugeot, yeah, they're part of Stellaris. But at the end of the day, the United States drove the automobile world. So all the oil that gets pumped, and that's why it's Anglo-American this, Anglo-American that, went to either Britain, to little, or the United States, which was the dominant player in automotive transportation. And you have 330 million plus or minus Americans today. A lot of them have cars, most of them. So at the end of the day, we had 100 years of we were the market. And gasoline was cheap, 25 cents a gallon when I was a kid. Went up to 50, everybody freaked out. Now it's a dollar, everybody lost it. That was the 1970s with stagflation. Now we're looking at the better part of $4 a gallon. My point is, the world is changing. You've got one, I'm going to use round numbers, 1.7 billion Chinese people and 1.7 billion East Indian people. And India is actually a larger population than China now. And of course, the world has changed. Everybody has iPhones and digital this and digital that, and they want cars. So if you take the better part of 3 billion people on the other side of the globe who want cars with gasoline, and you got 330 million Americans over here, and the world is over here. They are like, you know, they will, as they continue to mature as economies, have, you know, a fleet of cars that will make the United States look like England, and England look like a molecule. So the point is, oil prices will be dictated to those large automotive markets. And the United States is probably, it will not be the driving force in the global oil market for driving the majority of demand. The demand will be set by 3 billion people over here and 330 million people over here. So we're going to become price takers of oil. We're starting to see that. The Saudis and the Russians, and the Russians are playing political games because of Ukraine. But the Saudis are saying, you know, we need $100 a barrel because we want to build our infrastructure out. And that's how much it costs. And we need $100 a barrel. Okay. Well, as the markets in the other side of the globe are emerging, that pricing becomes the norm. But for the Americans, they're thinking, boy, gas used to be $1.89 a gallon. It's hard to maintain that unless we went to full U.S. production and sort of, you know, drew a border around ourselves, which you really can't because oil is a global commodity. So those pressures are pushing in the economy as well. And then you get the Federal Reserve, as I talked about yesterday. They're trying to tweak this giant national economy, which is part of a global economy. And here they are fiddling around with the interest rates. Oh, we're going to move the punch bowl around on the table. Well, you know, that tool may not work. It might have worked over the past 100 years from time to time. It was never really good trying to affect economic policy with monetary policy. And then you've got government fiscal policy, and government fiscal policy is driving inflation with its out of control spending. And the Federal Reserve is trying to tweak that back. And the big losers, of course, remember my three silos? You have the low earning, and then you got the middle earning, and then you got the rich people, and none of this applies to them. So you got these two silos. I'm telling you, the people on the back end, government's creating inflation. You got, you know, the Federal Reserve is fiddling around trying to protect these guys, and it's just killing them. The medicine's worse than the cure or the disease, and then the people in the middle, that just continues to shrink. You know, the smart ones are trying to get into that third silo, so none of this matters because they're rich, but that silo is continuing to shrink because it's kind of going this way. It's actually going like this with a few trickling this way. So all of this stuff is adding up to an economic situation. And that's why I started by making a joke, I guess, the Eastman Financial Doom and Gloom Report. And it's the idea is not to be doom and gloom. It's just that when you look at all of the things happening right now in the economy, these are turbulent times. And I say that from somebody who's lived through the 1950s, I was born in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s. You've seen the movie, and there are people older than I who've seen even more. But let me tell you, when you start to see all these pressure points, you can't just sit there and pretend tomorrow is the same. This normalcy bias is the worst place you can be. You got to open your eyes and just start thinking. Well, anyway, we'll see what the Fed does today. We'll talk about it tomorrow. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope I didn't ruin your lunch. And have a great day. Bye.